This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil in for John Dankosky. We're taking a deeper dive into the story of Cassandra See, a 17-year-old Connecticut girl who refused treatment for a curable cancer. Her story dominated national headlines after she was removed from her mother's care and put into the temporary custody of DCF. Earlier this month, the Connecticut Supreme Court agreed with the lower court that DCF can retain custody of the girl and force her to undergo chemotherapy. Today, Where We Live, we'll talk to Cassandra's attorney about the next steps for her. And we'll check in with a medical expert about patient rights. How have other states handled similar cases? Should Cassandra See be forced to undergo treatment because she's a minor? What do you think about how the state of Connecticut has become involved? You can join the conversation 860-275-7266, comment on our website, WMPR.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us in studio is Josh Mickdom. He's an assistant public defender and appellate attorney for Cassandra See.
Hey.
So, Josh, we know you represented Cassandra See before the state Supreme Court earlier this month in her appeal of a lower court ruling that gave custody, temporary custody, of the teen to the Department of Children and Families. For those listeners who don't know a lot about this case, tell us who Cassandra See is.
Well, she's a 17-year-old. She's a fairly run-of-the-mill teenager. She lives with her mom. She has a job at the mall. She's a smart, regular kid, personable, moody in the way you sort of expect teenagers to be. She's a regular kid.
But her life changed this summer when she started to have some health issues and a diagnosis of Hodgkin's lymphoma in September?
Right. And when that happened, she and her mother wanted more tests. They wanted to really explore other options than chemotherapy because of a lot of the nasty, lousy side effects of chemotherapy and long-term bad side effects. And her doctors who were recommending chemo, because Hodgkin's lymphoma is, as you said, highly curable if well-treated with chemo, they called the Department of Children and Families, as they must. That's what they're supposed to do. And that's how the whole thing got rolling.
So she, DCF, was given temporary custody of Cassandra in mid-December, and she's been at a local hospital since.
Yes. She's been in a hospital room. She can't leave her room because DCF says she can't leave her room. The backstory is that when the case was evolving, she was initially allowed to go home if she would continue chemo, and she did a little bit of chemo and then ran away for a week. And so DCF sees her as a flight risk, and so she is in her hospital room with someone at guard at the door all the time.
Now, we understand there have been discussions between attorneys, you, Cassandra's mother, DCF, to improve her situation so she's no longer being held at a hospital. We received a statement from DCF last night saying that DCF is exploring options for Cassandra to live in a specialized group home where her medical needs will continue to be addressed and where we know she'll receive the treatment she needs to recover and save her life. Goes on to say Cassandra is able to leave the hospital because her next chemo treatment will not occur for several weeks. However, there are other medical treatments that are required for Cassandra to continue her progress toward recovery. The group home that DCF is considering has the medical staff available to provide those treatments. So it sounds like some relief for Cassandra, but how does she feel about this?
Well, I did talk to her about it. This all really came up in the last few days, and I talked to her about it the day before yesterday, and I wasn't surprised at her response, which is that anywhere other than her one room in the hospital would be an improvement. I mean, what she said is she wants to be home with her mom and her cat, which is understandable because chemo is miserable. Usually people do their bout of chemo for a couple weeks, then they go home, they can be with their family. Sometimes people can keep working or doing the regular things they do. So Cassandra, by contrast, is always in the hospital. She only gets two visits a week from her mom. Her phone has been taken away. She has very limited internet access. And she's not getting any kind of regularized counseling. So it's a really hard situation to be in for her.
So you and her mother's attorneys argued before the state Supreme Court a few weeks ago that Cassandra should be able to choose how she wants to treat her cancer. Earlier this month, this is what her mother, Jackie Fortin, told us.
She's not going to die. She doesn't want to die. I'm not going to let her die. But she should have a choice over her body.
Can we talk about that further? So this is a compelling case on many levels, but the fact that she will turn 18 in about 8 months or so, and the fact that you argue with the mother and teen support that because she's so close to that age, she should be able to decide what happens to her body and how she treats this cancer.
Well, I mean, to be precise, what I argued is that she should get a chance to prove to the court that she is mature enough. I mean, I think we all agree, it's well understood that there's a presumption that people who are under 18 aren't mature enough. But the argument that Cassandra's mom's lawyers and I were making is that that's not a hard and fast rule. We make all kinds of exceptions because teenagers are in between, and they're also very unique. Some 14-year-olds are more mature than some 18 or 19 or 20-year-olds. And so for this kind of case, it's worth making an individual assessment to really see where the kid is at.
We're talking today about some of the bigger issues at the heart of the Cassandra C case. She's a 17-year-old cancer patient who refused chemotherapy. Earlier this month, the state Supreme Court ruled she must continue her treatment. You can join the conversation. Should a minor be able to refuse life-saving treatment? And what age should a person be able to make their health care decisions? I'm going to go to a caller right now. Joe from Hartford is calling Where We Live. Thanks for your call. What do you want to say?
I guess what I want to say is I'm in agreement with the state position on this. 17-year-old teenage girl who, based on the attorney's position, is that there should be an exception because she is mature enough. I think her actions speak to the opposite. I mean, she ran away. She's 17. She's probably not mature enough to do this. Furthermore, the mother hasn't. She stated that the child will not die because. Again, we'd like to seek alternative treatment. The state hasn't allowed us to do that. She hasn't stated what those alternative treatments might be. I don't believe the state has kept her from doing that. And that the treatments are toxic. Well, cancer is toxic. And studies have shown that this is a highly fatal. The mortality rate for this type of cancer is very high. And the treatment is exceptionally good. 85%, I believe, is where we're at. Now, this is a 17-year-old girl who understandably doesn't want to lose her hair, feels sick, and be isolated from her family and friends. What she needs is treatment and guidance, not a mother who is unrealistic and doesn't want to guide her through the process. That's my opinion.
All right. Thank you, Joe from Hartford. Josh Mickdom, again, the appellate attorney for Cassandra C. What's your response to that opinion?
I think Joe makes a lot of good points. And in all of this, I think it's important to keep in mind that, I certainly wasn't in court arguing that chemo is bad and that Hodgkin's lymphoma is otherwise curable. What this is really about is not whether it's a good decision or a bad decision, but at what point do we say a person can just make decisions about their own body? All of Joe's points are valid, but 9 months from now, none of them would matter. Cassandra could walk away from the hospital and get no treatment, and no one really could say anything about it because she would be an adult, and our law has long recognized that adults can say no to treatment. So in that sense, I'm sympathetic to what he's saying. It is hard to understand, but what this boils down to is we generally recognize that Americans have a right to make a bad decision. Adults do. They can make a decision that most of us might disagree with. The question is it a bright line when you become an adult and you can make that decision? Are you completely foolish one night and then wise the next? Or is it something that evolves?
So these bright lines, so to speak, appear arbitrary at times, especially in Cassandra's case because she's so close to turning 18. But doesn't society need these bright lines to mark, an end of adolescence and the beginning of adulthood? Can we go to court every time we have an argument about how a child should make a decision or if a parent has another decision for their child that it goes against medical treatment? I mean, what's the solution?
Well, bright lines are necessary. You're right. But this line is already not bright in our law. Some teenagers can be tried as adults, depending both on the crime that they committed and on their history. So you could have a kid the same age charged with the same crime and who's, let's say, 16, but based on that child's history and a court's assessment of that child's ability to get services in the juvenile system, one kid might go to the adult system, another kid might stay in the juvenile system. We also let kids get abortions. We let them get contraception. We let them donate blood without parental consent. So it's already a blurry line. Mm-hmm.
You brought up abortion. I believe today may be the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the right to for a woman to have an abortion. And we talk about different states have different laws about what minors can agree about medical treatment. I think in Connecticut at 16, a child could say they wanted an abortion. Is that right?
Suddenly I'm blanking on what that is. I think it's actually even more flexible. A lot of the laws about this talk about does a minor need treatment? Because we also have similar laws about seeking addiction services and psychological care. And a lot of it has to do with the doctor has to say, if this kid had to tell her parent, would that prevent her from getting care she needs? So a lot more discretion is in the hands of the doctor in those cases.
I want to go to the next caller here, Stephen from Wyndham. Thanks so much for calling Where We Live.
Hi. I think that girl will lose in court only because the modern brain science, especially in the last 2 years, you see it in insurance companies, you see it in drivers. The brain, according to like 2014, doesn't mature until the mid-20s. I think she would lose so bad in court today if they brought in like a couple medical brain research guys. She would get filleted in court.
All right, Stephen, thank you for your call. We were talking about next steps. So DCF may agree to move her into a specialized group home. But how about we talk about what's going to happen in court in terms of Cassandra's next steps?
Well, I want to address what Stephen raised because it's a really interesting question and it's something that wasn't well covered, but we did talk about in our briefs in the Supreme Court case. He's right. Brain science generally says that adolescents are impetuous and don't have good long-term planning. But when you drill down on that science, most of which has been brought up in the context of the criminal law, what you find is that for split-second decisions, for short-term decisions, adolescents are generally bad. But for longer-term decisions, things they can consider and mull over, they're not that bad. And in any case, all of these things are generalities. Mm-hmm. And there are always the standout adolescents, both who are more impetuous and less. So I think it's a good point, but I don't think that the science is as conclusive on this case as Stephen suggests.
Before I go to the next call, I wanted to bring up the mature minor doctrine because that was discussed before the state Supreme Court. This is a common law, or some states actually have adopted or have a statute on the books that gives a minor the right to make decisions regarding medical treatment. So explain what happened before the state Supreme Court and their opinion of this.
Well, we were asking them to adopt this doctrine, which hasn't been considered in Connecticut before. And they didn't say yay or nay to that. They said simply, there's enough evidence that the trial court, the juvenile court had, that's to say the court that we appealed from, and they were unwilling to look back at that and second guess the juvenile court judge. And part of the problem was that we didn't bring in a lot of good evidence at the trial court level. Because it's a new doctrine, because this case evolved very quickly, there sort of wasn't time and it caught everyone a little unawares. And so we came with kind of a lousy record to present to the Supreme Court. And they said on this record, I'm paraphrasing, they said it much more eloquently, but they said on this record, we're going to let the juvenile court stand.
I want to take a next call. This is David from Woodbury. David, what's your question for Where We Live?
I thought that a parents had a right of decision until a child becomes 18. And in this case, of course, the parents agreed with their daughter to not have this chemotherapy, which personally, as an adult, I think I would be trying to seek alternatives. But I thought this was a matter of parental rights. Maybe I'm ignorant of the law.
Well, no, David, I think you bring up a good point. We've heard from thousands of listeners about this story, and it's something that people have questioned. You know, if the parent agrees with the child and the parent is the decision maker, why can't she choose that alternative treatment? And I think we're going to actually get to that in the second segment of the show. So, David, keep listening. But do you want to comment on David's question?
Well, I think it raises sort of a broader question of what are our expectations about how parents raise teenagers? Because, I mean, DCF right now is acting as parent for Cassandra, and they are forcing her to get medical treatment. And initially, they strapped her down and sedated her. Not them, but the hospital strapped her down and sedated her to get treatment started. Now, if I had a 17-year-old child who wouldn't take medicine, I doubt very much that I could strap that child down and sedate that child without DCF getting involved if they knew about it. So, you know, if I had a 17-year-old, I would have to talk to her, try to persuade her, try to use other methods to bring her around, because 17-year-olds are practically grown. So it raises that question of what's the right way, the appropriate way to get minors who are almost adults to do the things we want them to do.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel in for John Dankosky. Today we're taking a closer look again into the story of a Connecticut teen with a curable cancer. If you have a comment or question, 860-275-7266. I want to take another call. Thanks so much for the listeners who are calling in. Chris from Port Chester, New York. What's your question?
Hi. Good morning. I'm curious, Josh, does this family have private insurance?
Well, I couldn't answer that because it's a juvenile court case. The things that I can talk about are the things that are already in public through the Supreme Court record. Other things are sealed, and so I can't really reveal things that I know that aren't
okay.
in public.
The reason why I ask is because I think this becomes an economic issue. My guess would be that she's probably on Medicaid, only because if they had private insurance, I don't think that it would have gotten into the state's hands. Is that a pretty proper assumption?
No, I don't think so, because I think at least presumably any parent who was in this position who said, I'm going to let my child refuse care, would have run into exactly what Ms. Fortin ran into, which is that the doctors would have called the state, because doctors are required to report what they think might be medical neglect. So in that sense, I don't know that it would have made any difference at all.
Okay, so this is just an issue of her rejecting the care completely.
Yeah.
What if does the mother agree that she rejected the care?
Yes, the mother does agree with the daughter.
It's outrageous. I think the government has too much control over our bodies. I think this is an outrageous case. I really feel sorry for the family.
Mm-hmm. Well, Chris,
that's my opinion.
Yeah, I appreciate your comment. And later on in the show, we're actually going to talk about other cases around the state. This has come up before, and oftentimes we've found that the courts do get involved and the children are forced to undergo treatment. We're going to hear more about that later in the show. Again, this is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel in for John Dankosky. Coming up, we're going to talk to a medical expert on informed consent. Stay tuned. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel in for John Dankosky. Today we're taking a closer look into the story of a 17-year-old Connecticut girl who's now in state custody and being forced to undergo chemo. You can join the conversation 860-275-7266, comment on our website, WMPR.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We wanted to explore the question of medical ethics and how hospitals work with families on difficult cases. To tell us more is Dr. Mark Mercurio. He's director of the Pediatric Ethics Program at Yale New Haven Hospital. He also directs the Program for Biomedical Ethics at Yale School of Medicine and is a professor of pediatrics. Dr. Mercurio, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So to start off, I was reading that most hospitals have something called an ethics committee. And is that what the pediatric ethics program is at the Yale New Haven Hospital?
Well, there are the pediatric ethics program it's actually at the Yale New Haven Children's Hospital. And there are two ethics committees. And the pediatric ethics program consists of an ethics committee specifically for the Children's Hospital, as well as educational programs for residents and other hospital staff.
And who sits on the committee?
There are physicians, both physicians based at the hospital as well as community physicians. There are nurses, social workers, clergy, members of the community, and others.
And the role of this ethics committee, is it just confer with staff on issues or the general public?
Well, the ethics committee's got really three tasks. When policies arise, when policy decisions are being made in the hospital that have an ethical component to it, the ethics committee is asked to weigh in or sometimes co-author those policies. The ethics committee also has a task specifically regarding education. But probably the biggest role for the ethics committee is in case consultation. So when cases arise where there are difficult ethical decisions to be made, the ethics committee is often consulted. And it's an advisory group. It's not a group with authority, but it's an advisory group that frequently gets involved in very difficult cases.
So you have a pediatric background, and we know when doctors talk about diagnoses and treatment plans with patients and families, but when the children are the patients, you know, how does that communication change between the healthcare provider and the family?
Well, obviously, it's going to depend to a great extent on the age of the child. But in broad terms, for an adult, essentially, the conversation, and of course, there's a ethics committee at Yale, and there's an adult ethics committee as well. But in general, a conversation with an adult between an adult and the medical team and the medical the physician will consist of the physician and the adult patient and any other individuals that that patient wants to bring involved. Typically, a member members of the family get involved, and an adult can choose who else they want to bring into the conversation. But with a child, the conversation necessarily includes the parents or guardian, almost always the parents. The parents will be involved in the conversation, so that the decisions that we make with adult patients are decisions in pediatrics that we make with parents. But of course, if the patient is 2 weeks old, the patient's obviously not involved in the decision. If the patient's 12 years old, on some level, the patient will be involved in the decision, and that's going to be kind of a sliding scale, if you will. Their involvement will increase as they get older.
Now, we're talking with you in the context of this Connecticut case, and I'm not going to ask you to talk specifics about the Cassandra C. case, but what I'm interested in as someone who has a background in ethics, medical ethics, if parents refuse treatment and you get to that point where there's no resolution, can you talk about what are the next steps? We had a caller earlier in the hour ask if a parent agrees that the treatment, they don't think the treatment's necessary, and it's a minor that is the patient, why doesn't the parent get the final say?
Well, so the next step, that's an excellent question. That's the heart of the matter, right? So the next steps for the physician involved in a case like that, after working with the parents, and of course, in the vast majority of these cases, the physicians working with the parents can come to an agreement on what should be done. But in the rare case where they do not, where the pediatrician feels this is something that the child really needs, this is something that's really very important to the best interest of the child, and the parents refuse the treatment, then the physician will commonly consult the ethics committee. And it's worth noting also that the parents are always open to consult an ethics committee, whether the patient, by the way, any patient in the hospital, you can always ask to speak to someone from the ethics committee and get them involved in your care if you wish. But certainly the parents have that option, and the physician has that option, and as do the nurses and other staff members. So should the ethics committee get involved, then usually the various parties will be brought together to talk through this and see if some agreement can be reached, and the ethics committee can often mediate an agreement, if you will, or make a recommendation that helps people reach an agreement. Ultimately, if no agreement can be reached, the physician really then has a decision to make. Is this an issue that I want to push? Do I feel so strongly about this that I want to take a legal route, right, and then bring this to a judge and say this child really needs this? In the case, for example, of a treatment that has the potential to be life-saving and the parents are refusing it, I think that in general, pediatricians would not just accept a refusal like that. Now, it's going to depend on how effective the treatment is and the difference in the outcome with or without the treatment. But if there's a vast difference in outcome with and without the treatment and the pediatrician feels strongly that this is in the child's best interest, then not only is the pediatrician free to pursue other channels, such as legal channels, I would say the pediatrician is obligated to pursue those channels.
And so if a resolution can't be reached, that's possibly when medical neglect comes into play. Can you define that for us?
Well, I think that, if we look at it as a legal term, I'm probably the wrong person to define it. But in general terms, and just understanding, if there's something if there's medical care that a child clearly needs and clearly would benefit greatly from, and the family doesn't pursue that, doesn't make that available to the child, I think that would be medical neglect. Now, of course, this is it's a matter of degree, right? So if we say, you should really give this child some acetaminophen because it'll make his sprained ankle feel better, or ibuprofen or something like that, that's one thing where no one would define it as medical neglect if the parents chose not to do that. If we say your child has a life-threatening bacterial infection and he needs antibiotics and the parents refuse that, we would say that is medical neglect. And so one has to choose one's battles. And see, it's a spectrum. But at some point, the treatment becomes so valuable to the child that to deny it is medical neglect.
We're speaking with Dr. Mark Mercurio, director of the Pediatric Ethics Program at Yale New Haven Children's Hospital. And we're talking with him in the context of medical ethics and the story of a Connecticut teen who refused treatment for curable cancer. We have a couple calls on the line. And Dr. Mercurio, we also have an attorney in the studio who may be able to talk a little bit more about the question of medical neglect. But I wanted to go to George in New London. Thanks so much for calling Where We Live. What's your question?
Well, I was wondering, I've been following this case since it hit the news, and I've been hearing an awful lot from the child's mother and her that they want to seek out alternative treatment programs that they consider to be as viable as chemo, and with that success rate. And from a medical standpoint, I was wondering if there has, if there is anything like that, because I've not heard any alternatives proposed yet.
That's an excellent question. I mean, that's really important. So we could say alternative treatments, when in, if we're considering any treatment, so if a pediatrician is saying that there is a treatment that I think this child should have and the parents have refused it, and again, not directing myself to this case specifically, but to the concept in general, the parents are refusing the treatment, of course, one question has to be raised. Well, are there other treatments aside from the one the pediatrician is recommending? Are there other treatments that could be equally effective or nearly as effective? And if there are, then certainly it would not be medical neglect if the parents chose those treatments instead of the other. So the question becomes, if the other treatments, if there's alternative treatments being pursued or preferred by the family, is there any evidence that those actually help the child, that are actually going to cure the disease? And in some diseases, for example, Hodgkin's disease, there are treatments, the chemotherapy, et cetera, that while they're very difficult, no doubt, they are very effective in dealing with the disease. There are other alternative treatments that people have occasionally sought that have never been proven to be effective. So I would say as a physician, that I would not accept that as an alternative if there was no evidence that it was actually going to, particularly in a life-threatening disease, in a possibly fatal disease like Hodgkin's, I wouldn't accept an alternative treatment unless there were evidence that it was indeed effective. And I'm not aware that there's something effective for Hodgkin's. But again, I have to say that's not my area of expertise, but I'm not aware that there is an herbal remedy or some other remedy aside from that that's used by the oncologists.
I wanted to expand a little further on the question of medical neglect. When a family's belief system or religion is counter to the advised treatment, you know, how are the decisions made to report a parent for medical neglect? Are they the same if someone says, I just don't want chemo because I don't want to go through with it?
Well, I think that ultimately a way to approach this in the way that I think it should be approached and the way we approach it here is that if there's a treatment that is likely to prevent significant harm, suffering, or death, and parents have refused it, we need to pursue that treatment. And if necessary, if there's no way, if communication doesn't work, if we can't reach an agreement, ultimately we'll go through legal channels. And that should occur regardless of the parent's rationale for refusing the treatment. So if their rationale is religious, or if their rationale is on some other basis, philosophical or any other basis, that if they are refusing a treatment we think is likely to prevent significant harm, suffering, or death to a child, that we would pursue it.
All right. Thanks for that answer, Dr. Mercurio. I just wanted to go to Josh Michtam in studio. Again, he's the appellate attorney for the Connecticut case, Cassandra C. Anything else you wanted to add about medical neglect and how these cases end up before a court?
I don't disagree with the way that Dr. Mercurio defined it. I think that's right. I also don't disagree that the parents' motivation doesn't really matter. And I think it's important to make a distinction in terms of what medical neglect is versus what I've been arguing and Cassandra's mother's lawyers have been arguing, which is that the concept of medical neglect only exists for children, right? Adults can always say no to treatment. So that concept runs up against self-determination as kids get older. So it's not a question of saying no to treatment for no reason just because, and the child is going to suffer and that no one is helping the child. It's a question of the child determining what happens to her own body when she's very close to being an adult who could do that if she wanted to. That's the tricky bit.
Yeah. Another caller from Hartford. Dorothy, you've been holding for a while. Thanks for your patience. What's your question?
My question is, why can't women, young women, have control over their own body? I know of my own experience with hospitals. Visiting a hospital makes me sick. And it started when I was a child the treatment I received when my mother allowed me to go into the hospital to have my tonsils out. Since then, I found out that other children have said to their parents, I don't want my tonsils out, and they haven't been taken out. Since my daughter was born 1979, I have told my doctor I take no medication, and I usually only go to see him when I feel healthy. That doesn't mean that I haven't had health challenges.
Well, thank you, Dorothy, for your call. And Dr. Mercurio, you know, people do have a sense of, you know, feeling like they want control of their bodies. When you encounter patients who may have an issue with a medication or an illness, the treatment options, how do you, you know, convey that, you know, how do you do that conversation with them so that can be conveyed that maybe they'll have a higher rate of cure if they do this versus something else?
Well, I think that I mean, Dorothy makes an important point, which is that people should have control over their own bodies. And adults of sound mind certainly should be able to refuse any medical treatment that they choose to refuse. The question becomes, at what point do we, and I don't think anybody would argue that a small child should have complete control over his own body and be able to refuse. So it becomes a threshold argument. At what point do we give children the right to refuse? And that's going to depend on how important the treatment is that they are refusing. And, for example, it's a long way from a tonsillectomy to chemotherapy for Hodgkin's disease. Mm-hmm. So working with someone who doesn't want their medication, I think a good physician who's dealing with an adult patient who feels that a medication's in that patient's benefit, I mean, part of the art of medicine is going to be to help people understand why it's going to benefit them and why this is what I'm recommending for you, but ultimately respecting their decision. With pediatrics, there's an added layer of difficulty to it, because if we can't convince a child that a certain treatment is really the best thing for the child, and if we can't convince a child this is what's necessary, sometimes it's still necessary to do it. In fact, as I say, sometimes we're actually obligated to do it. There are things that we do for children that they do not necessarily want us to do at the time, but and not only is it okay for us to do it, but actually they have a right, which brings to us an obligation to provide that for them. So that it's very different between dealing with adults and dealing with children, because it's with adults, it's clearer. It is, from an ethicist point of view, it's easier with adults. With children, it's much more difficult.
Josh?
Oh, I think Dr. Mercurio raises an important related point, which is that one thing that I saw as this case evolved was that Cassandra's doctors really, that's how they wanted to approach this. You could see that the whole legal question, they wished it weren't there, and they wanted to just talk to her. They wanted to connect her to other people who had chemo, because their approach was the approach that Dr. Mercurio is describing, an approach of persuasion. But, of course, they were up against the fact that she had already been removed by force from her home, and that sort of threw the whole thing off. And it gets to that question of what is the right way to persuade teenagers, what is the right way to work with patients and preserve their sense of bodily integrity. I mean, it's not inconceivable that if this hadn't gone down the way it went down, doctors might have persuaded her to get chemo voluntarily.
I just wanted to ask one more question to Dr. Mercurio before we go to break. And when we reported on the story for NPR, again, we heard from thousands of listeners about the Connecticut teen. One listener said, as a nurse, I would have to refuse to care for this patient. I couldn't live with myself knowing I was administering drugs against the patient and parents' wishes, regardless of age. So how do you resolve maybe conflicts that come up between medical staff and treatment plans?
Well, that's resolved in a two-step process, if you will. I mean, one is that we need to share with the staff exactly why we're doing what we're doing, why this is how the plan has come down to this. And usually, when there's a great deal of discomfort among the nursing staff, for example, about care, usually that helps. It doesn't fix the problem. There's no question that there are people doing things in the hospital. There are staff, there are doctors and nurses doing things that they're not totally comfortable with. But in the end, they realize this is perhaps the best of our bad choices. This is the best of the bad options that we have before us. So we do the best we can, recognizing that there's really no comfort or happiness to be found in some situations. We have to do the best we can. And so oftentimes there's a whole phenomenon called moral distress that first came up in the nursing literature maybe 20 to 25 years ago, but it's in the medical literature as well. And it has to do with sometimes feeling forced to do something you think is wrong. And this can be dealt with a lot of ways, by empowering staff, but also by communicating with people and say, sometimes it's happened in my experience that the staff is unhappy with doing a certain thing. So let's sit down and let's really talk about why we've made that decision. And they realize, yeah, I'm still not happy with it, but I get why we made it and why that's really the best thing for us to do. Ultimately, if someone is still absolutely not convinced, and that's never happened in my experience in pediatrics, frankly, the Children's Hospital here for decades, but ultimately, if a nurse is still not convinced and absolutely objects, I mean, I think in many situations, a different nurse would be assigned to the patient. But almost always, these things can be resolved if we sit down and talk about, yeah, I understand you're uncomfortable with what we're doing. Now you need to understand why we're doing. So, for example, the nurses who say that, I'm hopeful that somebody in the hospital, again, I'm not directly involved in the case at all, that somebody in the hospital has actually talked, and it may sound esoteric, but actually talked about the ethical principles involved as well as the obligations to the child involved and thought very carefully. If after that the nurse is still strongly objected, I suspect they would make accommodations to have a different nurse take care of the child.
I've been speaking with Dr. Mark Mercurio, director of the Pediatric Ethics Program at Yale New Haven Children's Hospital, also director of the Biomedical Ethics Program at Yale School of Medicine. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Lucy Nalpathanchelin for John Dankosky. Coming up, we'll explore how other states have dealt with cases similar to Connecticut's Cassandra C. This is WMPR. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchelin for John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, more young people are moving to the heart of cities, according to a report from think tank City Observatory. What's behind the trend, and is it happening in Connecticut? We'll listen back to a recent conversation we had on tomorrow's Where We Live. Today, we're talking about some of the issues raised by the recent state Supreme Court ruling about a 17-year-old girl, Cassandra C., who refused treatment for cancer. In studio again with us is Josh Mikdom, the appellate attorney for Cassandra C. And joining us now from Indiana is Jody Madeira, professor of law at Indiana University School of Law, an expert in the intersection of law and medicine and law and emotion. Hi, Jody.
Hello. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you. We know that, well, maybe we don't know. This is why I wanted you to be on the air. But Cassandra's not alone. Throughout the country, there have been other minors who have refused treatment for cancer, and their cases have also gone to court. So when we hear about the mature minor doctrine or exception that's been made in other states, can we talk about the origin of this exception and how it's come to be in some states but not in others like Connecticut?
Right. Now, actually, something that is very difficult to realize with the mature minor doctrine and all this current coverage is that it actually goes back to the Magna Carta, when the age of majority was set at 21. And we kind of inherited that when through the English common law here after the Revolution. Now, the 26th Amendment actually lowered the voting age from 21 to 18. And so that is why we're talking about 18 being the age of majority in most states. The mature minor doctrine came about judicially and through statute really in the 1960s and 70s, and where we had this cultural turn away from medical paternalism towards patient self-determination. Now, at common law, of course, the presumption was that you're competent to contract, to seek medical treatment, to get married, to serve in the military at 18. But these early exemptions from the common law really emerged for emergency medical treatment for minors, and also because of liability concerns for medical providers who ended up providing treatment to minors without parental consent. And there were really kind of two trends or patterns, you might say. First, some statutes gave treatment exceptions for specific diseases, STDs, contraception, alcohol, drug addiction treatment, mental health issues, and status exceptions. If you were a homeless child, became married, had a child, became pregnant, was a high school graduate, those types of things.
Your answer, thank you for that history fact, because one of the tweets coming into Where We Live was from a listener. I think the federal and state governments have determined the magic age is 18, and we've just learned it wasn't really magic. There's a purpose to that bright line. So can we talk again about how the states in the last 20 years have adopted this mature minor doctrine? Or has it been more in the courts? Because I think it's only like, what, less than one-third of states have this doctrine on the books?
Yes, you're right. It's really not that common. Now, like, again, as I mentioned, there are these two tracks. There is statutory, there's also judicial, and I don't think we've quite gotten to that yet. Parents do have rights through the due process clause of the 14th Amendment to raise their children as they see fit, and that extends to religious values and certainly making medical decisions. And minors do have constitutional rights, but they're much more limited, and it's less clear to the extent which minors' rights, when they're recognized, are distinguishable from those of their parents. And ethically, it's not enough to say that children do deserve to make decisions on their own. They must have demonstrated capacity to do so. Now, as you mentioned, this is not a common statute. Really, statutes are adopted by the legislature, hopefully not when these crisis cases come up, but through thought and careful determination. But courts have to routinely determine whether certain minors who are refusing treatment with or without parental permission are competent to make these decisions for themselves. When you turn to the judicial doctrine, there's many, many different problems with it. It's yet to be fully developed and consistently applied. Some courts defer adoption to state legislatures and refuse to apply the doctrine if there is no statute. Other courts have extended decision-making authority to minors for purposes of consenting to but not refusing medical treatment. And others would allow minors to refuse life-saving treatment if they had parental agreement. But no courts provide specific guidelines for really how to gauge minors' ability to understand these circumstances and how to appreciate the consequences of their decisions.
We're talking with Jody Madeira, professor of law at Indiana University School of Law, an expert in the intersection of law and medicine and law and emotion. If you have a comment or a call to Where We Live about the Cassandra C case and how similar cases have played out in other states, 860-275-7266. Now, I know that when we spoke earlier, Jody, you were looking at how the media has covered the Cassandra C case and then how there are similarities between cases in other states. You had mentioned Danny Hauser of Minnesota. Can you talk about that case?
Sure. So Danny Hauser is one of the most recent and I would say most prolifically covered cases. He was a 13-year-old Minnesota boy who refused chemo. I believe they were members of the Nemenha band. I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce it. They believed in traditional methods of healing, you might say. And the mother and father and son all espoused these beliefs. Also crucial was the fact that the son was homeschooled and in addition to being 13, could not read. So it was a family decision, I believe, to refuse chemotherapy when the state looked like it was going to intervene. The mother fled with her son, with Daniel, to California and ultimately returned after his sheriffs were going to post an arrest warrant for her. Daniel did end up undergoing conventional treatment, and apparently he has achieved full remission.
That's interesting. In the court briefs here in Connecticut, Josh Mictum is the appellate attorney for Cassandra C. In your court briefs, you cited, I think, an Illinois case where this case went before a court and it actually went in the favor of a child who was a Jehovah Witness. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that was the case of In Re E.G., which is the initials of the child. And Jehovah's Witnesses, per their faith, refused blood transfusions. And so she was diagnosed with leukemia, which I guess involves blood transfusions, and she consented to all treatment but blood transfusions. She was also 17. Her mother also agreed that she shouldn't have blood transfusions. The hospital went to a court and actually got an order ordering them or allowing the blood transfusions. So then she got the blood transfusions against her will. And then later she was able to have a more full hearing where she testified to the court, other people testified, and they put on evidence. And they persuaded a court that, yes, indeed, she understood what was going on. She was making this choice voluntarily. She was mature. She was smart. And she could make the choice. And so she, ironically, ultimately prevailed after she had gotten the transfusion she needed. And so that sort of was the leading case that we relied on, because the court looked at, they sort of made a test about maturity, understanding, ability to understand hypothetical situations, independence from parental influence, things like that. The Illinois court, the Supreme Court, really dug into it a little bit.
And this is something that Cassandra did not have the opportunity to prove her maturity in the lower court, or it just did not come up? There was no witnesses or evidence put on by her attorney at the time?
Well, I think the Supreme Court would say that she had the opportunity and didn't take it, which is pretty much fair. We're hoping maybe she'll get that opportunity in the future. But certainly she didn't have the kind of evidence to present to an appellate court that E.G. did.
I wanted to take a call, Roger from Norwich, calling into Where We Live. What's your question, Roger?
Well, I just want to say that this case is not really about the age of the patient or the insurance policy of the patient, but the burden of responsibility that the medical treatment for cancer is safe and effective has always been on the provider. It's never been any other way. I don't know why the lawyer doesn't make that argument.
Well, I don't think in this case there's any – I don't think we can make a good faith argument that chemo is not effective. At least, you know, I'm not a doctor, but from everything I've read, it is effective and it has side effects, but they are not as bad as the near certainty of death from Hodgkin's lymphoma. So our focus was really more on bodily integrity, on the rights that Jody has been talking about in terms of making decisions about your body no matter the outcome.
Jody Madeira, I wanted to go back to you. You know, from what I was reading, a lot of these similar cases, teens with Hodgkin's lymphoma that either did not want to undergo chemo or they had a religious reason for not wanting to undergo this treatment, they all ended up in their courts in that particular state, that all the way up to state Supreme Courts. Is this an issue that would ever be before the U.S. Supreme Court?
You know, it is so much an issue that I believe should be determined by each state for themselves. Certainly, you have broad principles of constitutional doctrine enumerated by the Supreme Court, as you said, the right to bodily autonomy, but you also have competing interests that have been equally emphasized. The state's right to preserve life has been emphasized in many different contexts, as has the parents' right to control the upbringing of their children. So I think that it has the same grounding as these other rights in the Supreme Court. And I think that the Supreme Court would be very unwilling to take a broad-based statement that says for once and for all, minors in all circumstances under 18 have this right to determine. I think they're much more comfortable leaving it on a case-by-case scenario to state courts.
I want to quickly take a call from Brendan. We just have under a minute, Brendan, from Meriden. What's your comment?
I just wanted to say that I read with the Cassandra case that she was afraid of the effects of the chemo, and that's definitely understandable. But the effects of the chemo are not as worse as the dying of cancer. It's not a nice, quiet, easy death.
All right, Brendan, we have heard that that sentiment from other listeners about this case. And Jody, I just wanted to ask you quickly, you know, we talk a lot about the state interest to preserve children's life, but at the same time, you know, society has a hard time grappling with the idea that a child with a very curable cancer would not want to undergo this treatment and maybe live 20, 30, 40 years from now.
Absolutely. There's a cultural conflict and a medical conflict with legal determinations of competency, but that does not dilute the fact that these legal determinations are real and that that must be applied in a court of law. Other competency determinations can control in other situations, such as bedside consultations. And in this case, you know, when you look at these other cases that have come up in the states, ranging from Daniel Hauser up very, very recently to Jacob Styler and Sarah Hirschberg, an Amish girl who refused treatment at 11, you see kind of two trends and patterns. You see either parents who agree to remove their child from chemotherapy because the child is having trouble dealing with side effects, or you really have this misunderstanding of chemo and how it fights cancer, and parents who try to pull their child away after the tumor comes back, but before the cancer is truly cured. And this case doesn't really fall nicely into either paradigm. So I think that's why it's especially crucial here to see what happens on the appellate level.
We'll have to leave it there, Jody. We ran out of time, but thank you, Jody Madeira, professor of law at Indiana University School of Law.
Thank you.
And Josh Mictum, appellate attorney for Cassandra C. This story is not going away here in Connecticut. We'll be updating you through the weeks and months. Thanks so much. This is Where We Live. John Dankosky is back on Monday.